Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more. With volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
With the Night Mail, a story of 2000 AD by Rudyard Kipling. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Adrian Stroat, Turks and Caicos Islands. With the Night Mail, a story of 2000 AD by Rudyard Kipling. At 9 o'clock of a gusty winter night, I stood on the lower stages of one of the GPO outward mail towers. My purpose was a run to Quebec in postal packet 162 or such other as may be appointed, and the Postmaster General himself countersigned the order. This talisman opened all doors, even those in the dispatching caisson at the foot of the tower, where they were delivering the sorted continental mail. The bags lay packed close as herrings in the long grey underbodies which our GPO still calls coaches. 5 such coaches were filled as I watched, and were shot up the guides to be locked onto their waiting packets 300 feet nearer the stars. From the dispatching caisson, I was conducted by a courteous and wonderfully learned official, Mr. L. L. Geary, second dispatcher of the Western Route, to the captain's room. This wakes an echo of old romance, where the male captains come on for their turn of duty. He introduces me to the captain of 162, Captain Purnell, and his relief, Captain Hodgson. The one is small and dark, the other large and red, but each has the brooding sheathed glance characteristic of eagles and aeronauts. You can see it in the pictures of our racing professionals, from L.V. Rauch to little Ada Worley, the fathomless abstraction of eyes habitually turned through naked space. On the notice board in the captain's room, the pulsing arrows of some 20 indicators register, degree by geographical degree, the progress of as many homeward-bound packets. The word Cape rises across the face of a dial. A gong strikes, the South African midweekly mail is in at the Highgate receiving towers. That is all. It reminds one comically of the traitorous little bell which in pigeon fancier's lots notifies the return of the Homer. "Time for us to be on the move," says Captain Purnell, and we are shot up by the passenger lift to the top of the dispatch towers. Our coach will lock on when it is filled and the clerks are aboard. Number 162 waits for us in slip E of the topmost stage. The great curve of her back shines frostily under the lights, and some minute alteration of trim makes her rock a little in her holding down slips. Captain Purnell frowns and dives inside. Hissing softly, 162 comes to rest as level as a rule. From her North Atlantic winter nose cap, worn bright as diamond with boring through uncounted leagues of hail, snow, and ice, to the inset of her 3 built-out propeller shafts is some 240 feet. Her extreme diameter, carried well forward, is 37. Contrast this with the 995 of any crack liner, and you will realize the power that must drive a hull through all weathers at more than the emergency speed of the cyclonic. The eye detects no joint in her skin plating save the sweeping hair crack of the bow rudder, Magniac's rudder, that assured us the dominion of the unstable air and left its inventor penniless and half-blind. It is calculated to Castelli's gull-wing curve. Raise a few feet of that all but invisible plate 3/8 of an inch, and she will yaw 5 miles to port or starboard ere she is under control again. Give her full helm, and she returns to her track like a whiplash. Cant the hull forward. A touch on the wheel will suffice, and she sweeps at your good direction, up or down. Open the complete circle, and she presents to the air a mushroom head that will bring her up, all standing within a half mile. "Yes," says Captain Hodgson, answering my thought. "Castelli thought he'd discovered the secret of controlling aeroplanes when he'd only found out how to steer dirigible balloons. Magniac invented his rudder to help war boats ram each other. And war went out of fashion, and Magniac went out of his mind because he said he couldn't serve his country any more. I wonder if any of us ever know what we're really doing. If you want to see the coach locked, you'd better go aboard. It's due now, says Mr. Geary. I enter through the door amidships. There is nothing here for display. The inner skin of the gas tanks comes down to within a foot or two of my head and turns over just short of the turn of the bilges. Liners and yachts disguise their tanks with decoration, but the GPO serves them raw under a lick of grey official paint. The inner skin shuts off 50 feet of the bow and as much of the stern, but the bow bulkhead is recessed for the lift shunting apparatus as the stern is pierced for the shaft tunnels. The engine room lies almost amidships. Forward of it, extending to the turn of the bow tanks, is an aperture, a bottomless hatch at present, into which our coach will be locked. One looks down over the combings 300 feet to the dispatching casing, whence voices boom upward. The light below is obscured to a sound of thunder as our coach rises on its guides. It enlarges rapidly from a postage stamp to a playing card, to a punt, and last a pontoon. The two clerks, its crew, do not even look up as it comes into place. The Quebec letters fly under their fingers and leap into the docketed racks, while both captains and Mr. Geary satisfy themselves that the coach is locked home. A clerk passes the waybill over the hatch combing. Captain Pennell thumb marks and passes it to Mr. Geary. Receipt has been given and taken. "Pleasant run," says Mr. Geary, and disappears through the door, which a foot-high pneumatic compressor locks after him. Captain Hodgson opens the great colloid underbody porthole through which I watch million-lighted London slide eastward as the gale gets hold of us. The first of the low winter clouds cuts off the well-known view and darkens Middlesex. On the south edge of it, I can see a postal packet's light ploughing through the white fleece. For an instant she gleams like a star ere she drops toward the Highgate receiving towers. "The Bombay Mail," says Captain Hodgson, and looks at his watch. "She's 40 minutes late." "What's our level?" I ask. 4,000. Aren't you coming up on the bridge?" The bridge? Let us ever bless the GPO as a repository of ancientest tradition. It is represented by a view of Captain Hodgson's legs, where he stands on the control platform that runs thwart ships overhead. The bow colloid is unshuttered, and Captain Pennell, one hand on the wheel, is feeling for a fair slant. The dial shows 4,300 feet. "It's steep tonight," he mutters as tier on tier of cloud drops under. "We generally pick up an easterly draft below 3,000 at this time of year. I hate slathering through fluff." "So does Van Cutsem. Look at him hunting for a slant," says Captain Hodgson. A fog light breaks cloud 100 fathoms below. The Antwerp night mail makes her signal and rises between two racing clouds far to port, her flanks blood red in the glare of Sheerness double light. The gale will have us over the North Sea in half an hour, but Captain Pennell lets her go composedly, nosing to every point of the compass as she rises. 5,000, 6,800. The dip dial reads ere we find the easterly drift, heralded by a flurry of snow at the 1,000-fathom level. Captain Pennell rings up the engines and keeps down the governor on the switch before him. There is no sense in urging machinery when Aeolus himself gives you good knots for nothing. We are away in earnest now, our nose notched home on our chosen star. At this level, the lower clouds are laid out, all neatly combed by the dry fingers of the east. Below that again is the strong westerly blow through which we rose. Overhead, a film of subtly drifting mist draws a theatrical gauze across the firmament. The moonlight turns the lower strata to silver without a stain, except where our shadow underruns us. Bristol and Cardiff double lights, those statelily inclined beams over Severn Mouth, are dead ahead of us, for we keep the southern winter route. Coventry Central, the pivot of the English system, stabs upward once in 10 seconds its spear of diamond light to the north, and a point or two off our starboard bow, the Leak, the great cloud-breaker of St. David's Head, swings its unmistakable green beam 25 degrees each way. There must be half a mile of fluff over it in this weather, but it does not affect the leak. Our planet's overlighted, if anything, says Captain Pennell at the wheel, as Cardiff Bristol slides under. I remember the old days of common white verticals that'd show 2,000 or 3,000 feet up in a mist, if you knew where to look for them. In really fluffy weather, they might as well have been under your hat. One could get lost coming home then, and have some fun. Now it's like driving down Piccadilly. He points to the pillars of light where the cloud breakers bore through the cloud floor. We see nothing of England's outlines, only a white pavement pierced in all directions by these manholes of variously coloured fire. Holy Island's white and red, St. Bee's interrupted white, and so on, as far as the eye can reach. Blessed be Sergeant, RNs, and the Dubois brothers, who invented the cloud breakers of the world whereby we travel in security. Are you going to lift for the Shamrock? Asked Captain Hodgson. Cork light, green, fixed, enlarges as we rush to it. Captain Pennell nods. There is heavy traffic hereabouts. The cloud bank beneath is streaked with running fissures of flame where the Atlantic boats are hurrying Londonward, just clear of the fluff. Mail packets are supposed, under the conference rules, to have the 5,000-foot lanes to themselves, but the foreigner, in a hurry, is apt to take liberties with English air. Number 162 lifts to a long-drawn wail of the breeze in the fore flange of the rudder, and we make Valencia, white, green, white, at a safe 7,000 feet, dipping our beam to an incoming Washington packet. There is no cloud on the Atlantic. The faint streaks of cream round Dingle Bay show where the driven seas hammer the coast. A big SATA liner is diving and lifting half a mile below us in search of some break in the solid west wind. Lower still lies a disabled Dane. She is telling the liner all about it in International. Our general communication dial has caught her talk and begins to eavesdrop. Captain Hodgson makes a motion to shut it off, but checks himself. Perhaps you'd like to listen, he says. Argoll of St. Thomas, the Dane whimpers. Report owners, 3 starboard shaft collar bearings fused. Can make Flores as we are, but impossible further. Shall we buy spares at Fayal? The liner acknowledges and recommends inverting the bearings. The Argoll answers that she has already done so without effect and begins to relieve her mind about cheap German enamels for collar bearings. The Frenchman assents cordially, cries, Courage, mon ami, and switches off. Their lights sink under the curve of the ocean. That's one of Lunt and Bleemer's boats, says Captain Hodgson. Serves them right for putting German campos on their thrust blocks. She won't be in Fayal tonight. By the way, wouldn't you like to look around the engine room? I've been waiting eagerly for this invitation, and I follow Captain Hodgson from the control platform, stooping low to avoid the bulge of the tanks. We know that Fleury's gas can lift anything, as the world-famous trials of 89 showed, but its almost indefinite powers of expansion necessitate vast tank room. Even in this thin air, the lift shunts are busy taking out 1/3 of its normal lift, and still 162 must be checked by an occasional downdraw of the rudder, or our flight would become a climb to the stars. Captain Pennell prefers an overlifted to an underlifted ship, but no two captains trim ship alike. When I take the ship, says Captain Hodgson, you'll see me shunt 40% of the lift out of the gas and run her on the upper rudder, with a swoop upwards instead of a swoop downwards, as you say. Either way will do. It's only habit. Watch our dip dial. Tim fetches her down once every 30 knots as regularly as breathing. So is it shown on the dip dial. For 5 or 6 minutes, the arrow creeps from 6,700 to 7,300. There is the faint zzz of the rudder, and back slides the arrow to 6,500 on a falling slant of 10 or 15 knots. In heavy weather, you jockey her with the screws as well, says Captain Hodgson, and unclipping the jointed bar which divides the engine room from the bare deck, he leads me onto the floor. Here we find Fleury's paradox of the bulk-headed vacuum, which we accept now without thought, literally in full blast. The 3 engines are HT&T assisted vacuum Fleury turbines running from 3,000 to the limit. That is to say, up to the point when the blades make the air bell, cut out a vacuum for themselves precisely as overdriven marine propellers used to do. 162's limit is now on account of the small size of her nine screws, which, though handier than the old colloid Ferlusens, bell sooner. The midship's engine, generally used as a reinforce, is not running, so the port and starboard turbine vacuum chambers draw direct into the return mains. The turbines whistle reflectively. From the low-arched expansion tanks on either side of the valves descend pillar-wise to the turbine chests, and thence the obedient gas whirls through the spirals of blades with a force that would whip the teeth out of a power saw. Behind is its own pressure, held in leash or spurred on by lift shunts. Before it, the vacuum where Fleury's ray dances in violet-green bands and whirled turbillions of flame. The jointed U-tubes of the vacuum chamber are pressure-tempered colloid. No glass would endure the strain for an instant. And a junior engineer with tinted spectacles watches the ray intently. It is the very heart of the machine, a mystery to this day. Even Fleury, who begat it, and unlike Magniac, died a multi-millionaire, could not explain how the restless little imp shuddered in the U-tube can, in the fraction of a second, strike the furious blast of gas into a chill greyish-green liquid that drains, you can hear it trickle, from the far end of the vacuum through the adduction pipes and the mains back to the bilges. Here it returns to its gaseous, one had almost written sagacious, state and climbs to work afresh. Bilge tank, upper tank, dorsal tank, expansion chamber, vacuum main return as a liquid, and bilge tank once more is the ordained cycle. Fleury's ray sees to that, and the engineer with the tinted spectacles sees to Fleury's ray. If a speck of oil, even the natural grease of a human finger, touch the hooded terminals, Fleury's ray will wink and disappear and must be laboriously built up again. This means half a day's work for all hands, and an expense of 170-odd pounds to the GPO for radium salts and such trifles. Now look at our thrust collars. You won't find much German compo there. Full jeweled, you see, says Captain Hodgson as the engineer shunts open the top of a cap. Our shaft bearings are CMC, Commercial Minerals Company, stones, ground with as much care as the lens of a telescope. They cost £37 apiece. So far we have not arrived at their term of life. These bearings came from number 97, which took them over from the old Dominion of Light, which had them out of the wreck of the Perseus aeroplane in the years when men still flew linen kites over thorium engines. They are shining reproof to all low-grade German ruby enamels, so-called Bort facings, and the dangerous and unsatisfactory alumina compounds, which please dividend-hunting owners and turn skippers crazy. The rudder gear and the gas lift shunt, seated side by side under the engine room dials, are the only machines in visible motion. The former sighs from time to time as the oil plunger rises and falls half an inch. The latter, cased and guarded like the U-tube aft, exhibits another Fleury ray, but inverted and more green than violet. Its function is to shunt the lift out of the gas, and this it will do without watching. That is all. A tiny pump rod, wheezing and whining to itself beside a sputtering green lamp. 150 feet aft down the flat-topped tunnel of the tanks, a violet light, restless and irresolute. Between the two, like eel baskets laid on their side, accentuate the empty perspectives. You can hear the trickle of the liquefied gas flowing over the vacuum of the bilge tanks, and the soft gluck-glock of gas locks, closing as Captain Pennell brings 162 down by the head. The hum of the turbines and the boom of the air on our skin is no more than a cotton wool wrapping to the universal stillness, and we are running an 18-second mile. I peer from the fore end of the engine room over the hatch combings into the coach. The mail clerks are sorting the Winnipeg, Calgary, and medicine hat bags, but there is a pack of cards ready on the table. Suddenly a bell thrills. The engineers run to the turbine valves and stand by, but the spectacled slave of the ray in the U-tube never lifts his head. He must watch where he is. We are hard braked and going astern. There is language from the control platform. Tim's sparking badly about something, says the unruffled Captain Hodgson. Let's look. Captain Pennell is not the suave man we left half an hour since, but the embodied authority of the GPO. Ahead of us floats an ancient, aluminium-patched, twin-screw tramp of the dingiest, with no more right to the 5,000-foot lane than has a horse cart to a modern town. She carries an obsolete barbette conning tower, a 6-foot affair with railed platform forward, and our warning beam plays on the top of it as a policeman's lantern flashes on the area sneak. Like a sneak thief, too, emerges a shock-headed navigator in his shirt sleeves. Captain Pennell wrenches open the colloid to talk with him man to man. There are times when science does not satisfy. What under the stars are you doing here, you skyscraping chimney sweep? He shouts as we two drift side by side. Do you know this is a mail lane? You call yourself a sailor, sir. You ain't fit to peddle toy balloons to an Eskimo. Your name and number. Report and get down and be... I've been blown up once, the shock-headed man cries hoarsely as a dog barking. I don't care two flips of a contact for anything you can do, Postie. Don't you, sir? But I'll make you care. I'll have you towed stern first to disco and broke up. You can't recover insurance if you're broken for obstruction. Do you understand that? Then the stranger bellows. Look at my propellers. There's been a wallywar down under that has knocked us into umbrella frames. We've been blowing up about 40,000 feet. We're all one conjurer's watch inside. My mate's arms broke, my engineer's head's cut open, my ray went out with the engine smashed, and for pity's sake, give me my height, Captain. We doubt we're dropping. 6,800. Can you hold it? Captain Pennell overlooks all insults and leans half out of the colloid, staring and snuffing. The stranger leaks pungently. We ought to blow into St. John's with luck. We're trying to plug the fore tank now, but she's simply whistling it away, her captain wails. She's sinking like a log, says Captain Pennell in an undertone. Call up the bank's mark boat, George. Our dip dial shows that we, keeping abreast the tramp, have dropped 500 feet the last few minutes. Captain Pennell presses a switch and our signal beam begins to swing through the night, twizzling spokes of light across infinity. That'll fetch something, he says, while Captain Hodgson watches the general communicator. He has called up the North Bank's mark boat, a few hundred miles west, and is reporting the case. I'll stand by you, Captain Pennell roars to the lone figure on the conning tower. Is it as bad as that? Comes the answer. She isn't insured, she's mine. Might have guessed as much, mutters Hodgson. Owner's risk is the worst risk of all. Can't I fetch St. John's? Not even with this breeze, the voice quavers. Stand by to abandon ship. Haven't you any lift in you, fore or aft? Nothing but the midship tanks, and they're none too tight. You see, my ray gave out and... he coughs in the reek of the escaping gas. You poor devil. This does not reach our friend. What does the mark boat say, George? Wants to know if there's any danger to traffic. Says she's in a bit of weather herself and can't quit station. I've turned in a general call, so even if they don't see our beams, someone's bound to help, or else we must. Shall I clear our slings? Hold on. Here we are. A planet liner, too. She'll be up in a tick. Tell her to have her slings ready, cries her brother captain. There won't be much time to spare. Tie up your mate, he roars to the tramp. My mate's all right. It's my engineer. He's gone crazy. Shunt the lift out of him with a spanner. Hurry! But I can make St. John's if you'll stand by. You'll make the deep, wet Atlantic in 20 minutes. You're less than 5,800 now. Get your papers. A planet liner eastbound heaves up in a superb spiral and takes the air of us humming. Her underbody colloid is open and her transporter slings hang down like tentacles. We shut off our beam as she adjusts herself, steering to a hair over the tramp's conning tower. The mate comes up, his arms strapped to his side, and stumbles into the cradle. A man with a ghastly scarlet head follows, shouting that he must go back and build up his ray. The mate assures him that he will find a nice new ray already in the liner's engine room. The bandaged head goes up, wagging excitedly. A youth and a woman follow. The liner cheers hollowly above us, and we see the passengers' faces at the saloon colloid.
"That's a good girl. What's the fool waiting for now?" says Captain Purnell.
The skipper comes up, still appealing to us to stand by and see him fetch St. John's. He dives below and returns, at which we little human beings in the void cheer louder than ever, with the ship's kitten. Up fly the liner's hissing slings. Her underbody crashes home and she hurtles away again. The dial shows less than 3,000 feet. The mark boat signals we must attend to the derelict, now whistling her death song as she falls beneath us in long sick zigzags. "Keep our beam on her and send out a general warning," says Captain Purnell, following her down. There is no need. Not a liner in air but knows the meaning of that vertical beam and gives us and our quarry a wide berth.
"But she'll drown in the water, won't she?" I ask.
"Not always," is his answer. "I've known a derelict upend and sift her engines out of herself and flicker round the lower lanes for 3 weeks on her forward tanks only. We'll run no risks. Pith her, George, and look sharp. There's weather ahead."
Captain Hodgson opens the underbody colloid, swings the heavy pithing iron out of its rack, which in liners is generally cased as a settee, and at 200 feet releases the catch. We hear the whir of the crescent-shaped arms opening as they descend. The derelict's forehead is punched in, starred across and rent diagonally. She falls stern first, our beam upon her, slides like a lost soul down the pitiless ladder of light, and the Atlantic takes her.
"A filthy business," says Hodgson. "I wonder what it must have been like in the old days." The thought had crossed my mind too. What if that wavering carcass had been filled with international speaking men of all the internationalities, each one of them taught, that is the horror of it, that after death he would very possibly go forever to unspeakable torment. And not half a century since, we, one knows now that we are only our fathers re-enlarged upon the earth, we, I say, ripped and rammed and pithed to admiration. Here Tim, from the control platform, shouts that we are to get into our inflators and to bring him his at once. We hurry into the heavy rubber suits, and the engineers are already dressed, and inflate at the air pump taps. GPO inflators are thrice as thick as the racing man's flickers and chafe abominably under the armpits. George takes the wheel until Tim has blown himself up to the extreme of rotundity. If you kicked him off the CP to the deck, he would bounce back. But it is 162 that will do the kicking.
"The mark boat's mad. Stark raving crazy," he snorts, returning to command. "She says there's a bad blowout ahead and wants me to pull over to Greenland. I'll see her pitched first. We wasted an hour and a quarter over that dead duck down under, and now I'm expected to go rubbing my back all round the pole. What does she think a postal packet's made of? Gummed silk? Tell her we're coming on straight, George."
George buckles him into the frame and switches on the direct control. Now under Tim's left toe lies the port engine accelerator, under his left heel the reverse, and so with the other foot. The lift shunt stops stand out on the rim of the steering wheel where the fingers of his left hand can play on them. At his right hand is the midship's engine lever ready to be thrown into gear at a moment's notice. He leans forward in his belt, eyes glued to the colloid, and one ear cocked toward the general communicator. Henceforth, he is the strength and direction of 162, through whatever may befall. The bank's mark boat is reeling out pages of ABC directions to the traffic at large. We are to secure all loose objects, hood up our flurry rays, and on no account to attempt to clear snow from our conning towers till the weather abates. Underpowered craft, we are told, can ascend to the limit of their lift, mail packets to look out for them accordingly. The lower lanes westward are pitting very badly, with frequent blowouts, vortices, laterals, etc. Still the clear dark holds up unblemished. The only warning is the electric skin tension. I feel as though I were a lace maker's pillow.
and an irritability which the gibbering of the general communicator increases almost to hysteria. We have made 8,000 feet since we pithed the tramp, and our turbines are giving us an honest 210 knots. Very far to the west, an elongated blur of red, low down, shows us the North Bank's mark boat. There are specks of fire round her rising and falling, bewildered planets about an unstable sun, helpless shipping hanging on to her light for company's sake. No wonder she could not quit station. She warns us to look out for the backwash of the bad vortex in which, her beam shows it, she is even now reeling. The pits of gloom about us begin to fill with very faintly luminous films, wreathing in uneasy shapes. One forms itself into a globe of pale flame that waits shivering with eagerness till we sweep by. It leaps monstrously across the blackness, alights on the precise tip of our nose, pirouettes there an instant, and swings off. Our roaring bow sinks as though that light were lead, sinks and recovers to lurch and stumble again beneath the next blowout. Tim's fingers on the lift shunt strike chords of numbers, 147, 246, 753, and so on, for he is running by his tanks only, lifting or lowering her against the uneasy air. All three engines are at work, for the sooner we have skated over this thin ice, the better. Higher we dare not go. The whole upper vault is charged with pale krypton vapours, which our skin friction may excite to unholy manifestations. Between the upper and the lower levels, 5,000 and 7,000 hints the mark boat, we may perhaps bolt through if our bow clothes itself in blue flame and falls like a sword. No human skill can keep pace with the changing tensions. A vortex has us by the beak, and we dive down a 2,000-foot slant at an angle, the dip dial in my bouncing body record it, of 35. Our turbines scream shrilly. The propellers cannot bite on the thin air. Tim shunts the lift out of 5 tanks at once and by sheer weight drives her bullet-wise through the maelstrom till she cushions with a jar on an upgust 3,000 feet below. "Now we've done it," says George in my ear. "Our skin friction that last slide has played old Harry with the tensions. Look out for laterals, Tim. She'll want some holding." "I've got her," is the answer. "Come up, old woman." She comes up nobly, but the laterals buffet her left and right like the pinions of angry angels. She is jolted off her course in 4 ways at once, and cuffed into place again, only to be swung aside and dropped into a new chaos. We are never without a corpuscent grinning on our bows, or rolling head over heels from nose to midships, and to the crackle of electricity around and within us is added once or twice the rattle of hail, hail that will never fall on any sea. Slow we must, or we may break our back, pitch poling. "Air's a perfectly elastic fluid," roars George above the tumult. "About as elastic as a head sea off the fast net, ain't it?" He is less than just to the good element. If one intrudes on the heavens when they are balancing their vault accounts, if one disturbs the high god's market rates by hurling steel hulls at 90 knots across tremblingly adjusted electric tensions, one must not complain of any rudeness in the reception. Tim met it with an unmoved countenance, one corner of his under lip caught up on a tooth, his eyes fleeting into the blackness 20 miles ahead, and the fierce sparks flying from his knuckles at every turn of the hand. Now and again, he shook his head to clear the sweat trickling from his eyebrows, and it was then that George, watching his chance, would slide down the life rail and swab his face quickly with a big red handkerchief. I never imagined that a human being could so continuously labour and so collectedly think as did Tim through that hell's half hour when the flurry was at its worst. We were dragged hither and yon by warm or frozen suctions, belched up on the tops of wallywas, spun down by vortices and clubbed aside by laterals under a dizzying rush of stars in the company of a drunken moon. I heard the rushing click of the midship engine lever sliding in and out, the low growl of the lift shunts, and, louder than the yelling winds without, the scream of the bow rudder gouging into any lull that promised hold for an instant. At last we began to claw up on a cant, bow rudder and port propeller together, Only the nicest balancing of tanks saved us from spinning like the rifle bullet of the old days. "We've got to hitch the windward of that Mark boat somehow," George cried. "There's no windward," I protested feebly, where I swung shackled to a stanchion. "How can there be?" He laughed. As we pitched into a 1,000-foot blowout, that red man laughed beneath his inflated hood. "Look," he said, "we must clear those refugees with a high lift." The Mark boat was below and a little to the southwest of us, fluctuating in the centre of her distraught galaxy. The air was thick with moving lights at every level. I take it most of them were trying to lie head to wind, but not being hydras, they failed. An under-tanked Mirabi boat had risen to the limit of her lift and, finding no improvement, had dropped a couple of thousand. There she met a superb Waliwa and was blown up, spinning like a dead leaf. Instead of shutting off, she went astern and naturally rebounded as from a wall almost into the Mark boat, whose language, RGC took it in, was humanly simple. "If they'd only write it out quietly, it'd be better," said George in a calm, as we climbed like a bat above them all. "But some skippers will navigate without enough lift. What does that Tad boat think she is doing, Tim?" "Playing kiss in the ring," was Tim's unmoved reply. A transasiatic direct liner had found a smooth and butted into it full power, but there was a vortex at the tail of that smooth, so the TAD was flipped out like a pea from off a fingernail, breaking madly as she fled down and all but overending. "Now I hope she's satisfied," said Tim. "I'm glad I'm not a Mark boat. Do I want help?" The CG dial had caught his ear. "George, you may tell that gentleman with my love, love, remember, George, that I do not want help. Who is the officious sardine tin?"
"A Rimouski droger, on the lookout for a tow." "Very kind of the Rimouski droger. The postal packet isn't being towed at present."
"Those drogers will go anywhere on a chance of salvage," George explained. "We call them kittywakes." A long-beaked, bright steel 90-footer floated at ease for one instant within hail of us, her slings coiled ready for rescues, and a single hand in her open tower. He was smoking. Surrendered to the insurrection of the air through which we tore our way, he lay in absolute peace. I saw the smoke of his pipe ascend untroubled ere his boat dropped, it seemed, like a stone in a well. We had just cleared the Mark boat and her disorderly neighbours when the storm ended as suddenly as it had begun. A shooting star to northward filled the sky with the green blink of a meteorite dissipating itself in our atmosphere. Said George, "That may iron out all the tensions." Even as he spoke, the conflicting winds came to rest. The levels filled. The laterals died out in long, easy swells. The airways were smoothed before us. In less than 3 minutes, the covey around the Mark boat had shipped their power lights and whirred away upon their businesses. "What's happened?" I gasped. The nerve storm within the vault tingle without had passed. My inflators weighed like lead. "God, he knows," said Captain George soberly. "That old shooting star's skin friction has discharged the different levels. I've seen it happen before." Phew, what a relief. We dropped from 10 to 6,000 and got rid of our clammy suits. Tim shut off and stepped out of the frame. The Mark boat was coming up behind us. He opened the colloid in that heavenly stillness and mopped his face. "Hello, Williams," he cried. "A degree or two out of station, ain't you?" "Maybe," was the answer from the Mark boat. "I've had some company this evening." "So I noticed. Wasn't that quite a little draft?" "I warned you. Why didn't you pull out round by Disco? The eastbound packets have." "Me? Not till I'm running a polar consumptive sanatorium boat. I was squinting through a colloid before you were out of your cradle, my son." "I'd be the last man to deny it," the captain of the Mark boat replies softly. "The way you handled her just now, I'm a pretty fair judge of traffic in a vault flurry. It was 1,000 revolutions beyond anything I've ever seen." Tim's back supples visibly to this oiling. Captain George on the CP winks and points to the portrait of a singularly attractive maiden pinned up on Tim's telescope bracket above the steering wheel. "I see. Wholly and entirely do I see." There is some talk overhead of coming round to tea on Friday, a brief report of the derelict's fate, and Tim volunteers as he descends. "For an ABC man, young Williams is less of a high-tension fool than some. Were you thinking of taking her on, George? Then I'll just have a look around that port thrust. Seems to me it's a trifle warm, and we'll jog along.
The Mark boat hums off joyously and hangs herself up in her appointed eyrie. Here she will stay, a shuttleless observatory, a lifeboat station, a salvage tug, a court of ultimate appeal come meteorological bureau, for 300 miles in all directions, till Wednesday next when her relief slides across the stars, to take her buffeted place. Her black hull, double conning tower, and ever-ready slings represent all that remains to the planet of that odd old word, authority. She is responsible only to the aerial board of control, the ABC of which Tim speaks so flippantly, but that semi-elected, semi-nominated body of a few score persons of both sexes controls this planet. Transportation is civilization, our motto runs. Theoretically, we do what we please so long as we do not interfere with the traffic and all it implies. Practically, the ABC confirms or annuls all international arrangements and, to judge from its last report, finds our tolerant, humorous, lazy little planet only too ready to shift the whole burden of private administration on its shoulders. I discuss this with Tim sipping mate on the CP while George fans her along over the white blur of the banks in beautiful upward curves of 50 miles each. The dip dial translates them on the tape in flowing freehand. Tim gathers up a skein of it and surveys the last few feet, which record 162's path through the vault flurry.
I haven't had a fever chart like this to show up in 5 years, he says ruefully.
A postal packet's dip dial records every yard of every run. The tapes then go to the ABC, which collates and makes composite photographs of them for the instruction of captains. Tim studies this irrevocable past, shaking his head.
Hello, here's a 1,500-foot drop of 85 degrees. We must have been standing on our heads then, George.
You don't say, George answers. I fancied I noticed it at the time. George may not have Captain Pennell's cat-like swiftness, but he is all an artist to the tips of the broad fingers that play on the shunt stops. The delicious flight curves come away on the tape with never a waver. The Mark boat's vertical spindle of light lies down to eastward, setting in the face of the following stars. Westward, where no planet should rise, the triple verticals of Trinity Bay, we keep still to the southern route, make a low-lifting haze. We seem the only thing at rest under all the heavens, floating at ease till the Earth's revolution shall turn up our landing towers. And, minute by minute, our silent clock gives us a 16-second mile.
Some fine night, says Tim, we'll be even with that clock's master.
He's coming now, says George over his shoulder. I'm chasing the night west. The stars ahead dim no more than if a film of mist had been drawn under unobserved, but the deep air boom on our skin changes to a joyful shout.
The dawn gust, says Tim. It'll go on to meet the sun. Look, look! There's the dark being crammed back over our bow. Come to the after colloid. I'll show you something.
The engine room is hot and stuffy. The clerks in the coach are asleep, and the slave of the ray is near to follow them. Tim slides open the aft colloid and reveals the curve of the world, the ocean's deepest purple, edged with fuming and intolerable gold. Then the sun rises and through the colloid strikes out our lamps. Tim scowls in his face.
Squirrels in a cage, he mutters. That's all we are, squirrels in a cage. He's going twice as fast as us. Just you wait a few years, my shining friend, and we'll take steps that will amaze you. We'll, Joshua, you.
Yes, that is our dream, to turn all Earth into the Vale of Ajalon at our pleasure. So far, we can drag out the dawn to twice its normal length in these latitudes, but some day, even on the equator, we shall hold the sun level in his full stride. Now we look down on a sea thronged with heavy traffic. A big submersible breaks water suddenly. Another and another follow with a swash and a suck and a savage bubbling of relieved pressures. The deep-sea freighters are rising to lug up after the long night, and the leisurely ocean is all patterned with peacock's eyes of foam.
We'll lug up too, says Tim. And when we return to the CP, George shuts off, the colloids are opened, and the fresh air sweeps her out.
There is no hurry. The old contracts, they will be revised at the end of the year,
allow 12 hours for a run which any packet can put behind her in 10. So we breakfast in the arms of an easterly slant which pushes us along at a languid 20. To enjoy life and tobacco, begin both on a sunny morning, half a mile or so above the dappled Atlantic cloud belts, and after a vault flurry which has cleared and tempered your nerves. While we discuss the thickening traffic with the superiority that comes of having high-level reserve to ourselves, we heard, and I for the first time, the morning hymn of a hospital boat. She was cloaked by a skein of raveled fluff beneath us, and we caught the chant before she rose into the sunlight. "O ye winds of God," sang the unseen voices, "bless ye the Lord, praise him and magnify him for ever." We slid off our caps and joined in. When our shadow fell across her great open platforms, they looked up and stretched out their hands neighbourly while they sang. We could see the doctors and the nurses and the white button-like faces of the cot patients. She passed slowly beneath us, heading northward, her hull wet with the dews of the night, all ablaze in the sunshine. So took she the shadow of a cloud and vanished, her song continuing, "O ye holy and humble men of heart, bless ye the Lord, praise him and magnify him for ever." She's a public lunger, or she wouldn't have been singing the Benedicity, and she's a Greenlander, or she wouldn't have snow blinds over her colloids, said George at last. She'll be bound for Frederickshaven, or one of the glacier sanatoriums for a month. If she was an accident ward, she'd be hung up at the 8,000-foot level. Yes, consumptives. Funny how the new things are the old things. I've read in books, Tim answered, that savages used to haul their sick and wounded up to the tops of hills because microbes were fewer there. We hoist them into sterilized air for a while. Same idea. How much do the doctors say we've added to the average human life of a man? 30 years, says George with a twinkle in his eye. Are we going to spend all of them up here, Tim? Flap along, then. Flap along. Who's hindering? The senior captain laughed as we went in. We held a good lift to clear the coastwise and continental shipping, and we had need of it. Though our route is in no sense a populated one, there is a steady trickle of traffic this way along. We met Hudson Bay furriers out of the Great Preserve, hurrying to make their departure from Buena Vista with Sable and Black Fox for their insatiable markets. We overcrossed Keewatin liners small and cramped, but their captains, who see no land between Trepassee and Blanco, know what gold they bring back from West Africa. Transasiatic directs, we met, soberly ringing the world round the 50th meridian at an honest 70 knots, and white-painted Ackroyd and Hunt fruiters out of the south fled beneath us, their ventilated hulls whistling like Chinese kites. Their market is in the north among the northern sanatoria, where you can smell their grapefruit and bananas across the cold snows. Argentine beef boats we sighted too, of enormous capacity and unlovely outline. They too feed the northern health stations in ice-bound ports where submersibles dare not rise. Yellow-bellied ore flats and ungaver petrol tanks punted down leisurely out of the north like strings of unfrightened wild duck. It does not pay to fly minerals and oil a mile farther than is necessary, but the risks of transshipping to submersibles in the ice pack of Nain and Hebron are so great that these heavy freighters fly down to Halifax direct and scent the air as they go. They are the biggest tramps aloft except the Athabasca grain tubs, but these last, now that the wheat is moved, are busy over the world's shoulder, timber lifting in Siberia. We held to the St. Lawrence. It is astonishing how the old waterways will pull us children of the air, and followed his broad line of black between its drifting ice blocks, all down the park that the wisdom of our fathers, but everyone knows the Quebec run. We dropped to the Heights receiving towers 20 minutes ahead of time, and there hung at ease till the Yokohama intermediate packet could pull out and give us our proper slip. It was curious to watch the action of the holding down clips all along the frosty river front as the boats cleared or came to rest. A big hamburger was leaving Pont Levis, and her crew, unshipping the platform railings, began to sing Elsinore, the oldest of our chanties. You know it, of course. Mother Rugen's tea house on the Baltic, 40 couple waltzing on the floor, and you can watch my ray for I must go away and dance with Ella Swain at Elsinore. Then, while they sweat at home the covering plates, nor, 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 west from Sourabaya to the Baltic, 90 knot an hour to the score, Mother Rugen's tea house on the Baltic, and a dance with Ella Swain at Elsinore. The clips parted with a gesture of indignant dismissal, as though Quebec, glittering under her snows, were casting out these light and unworthy lovers. Our signal came from the heights. Tim turned and floated up, but surely then it was with passionate appeal that the great tower arms flung open. Or did I think so? Because on the upper staging, a little hooded figure also opened her arms, wide towards her father. In 10 seconds, the coach with its clerks clashed down to the receiving caisson. The hostlers displaced the engineers at the idle turbines, and Tim, prouder of this than all, introduced me to the maiden of the photograph on the shelf. "And by the way," said he to her, stepping forth in sunshine under the hat of civil life, "I saw young Williams in the Mark boat. I've asked him to tea on Friday." End of With the Night Mail, A Story of 2000 AD, by Rudyard Kipling. Read by Adrian Strowett, Turks and Caicos Islands.